Dr. Michael Roizen.
Dr. Michael Roizen.
You, the Owner's Manual Radio Show.
You know, my son went to WashU in St. Louis, and I don't know if he ever met our guest, who's a professor of research at Washington University, the Ira Codner Professor of Research, with a specialty in hospice care, and it's everything you want to know about hospice. We're talking to a real lifelong pro. She literally has devoted her life to it. Dr. Deborah Parker Oliver is a PhD as well as an MSW and is the author of the book Legacies from the Living Room. We, of course, are brought to you by our usual sponsors, Life's First Naturals. Go to their website to see the randomized double-blind controlled trials on Life's First Naturals, bovine colostrum, and their probiotic Truebiotics, as well as the new data, and it's mainly from the blogosphere, on dye rescue and its benefits in helping transition to increased dosage of both Mounjaro and Ozempic, otherwise known as Zepbound, and Wegovia as well. And the second sponsor is LongevityPlaybook.com. Go to their website to find the randomized controlled studies that are quoted there, or just sign up for the newsletter at, it's free, at LongevityPlaybook.com. Deborah, if you will, my son was an MD, PhD in the MSTP program at WashU St. Louis in the past. Would he have come in contact with you? It's such an important field, and I feel medical students don't get to see it.
Depends on when he was there. Our program is actually pretty new. I've only been there 3 years. Our division of palliative medicine has only been in existence about 5 years. We entered the educational arena at WashU a little bit later, so it depends on what year.
But you've been involved in the field of hospice literally your whole career.
That's correct. And I was at University of Missouri for 25 years before I came to WashU, and then I was in the field in hospice before that for 20 years.
Deborah, your great book is called Legacies from the Living Room, A Love-Grief Equation. Why'd you call it that?
A couple of reasons. First, important things happen in living rooms. Family conversations. Our living room was one that was always filled with lots of family pictures. We had what we called the wall of fame from all of the years of the kids' pictures. And so most of our family stuff happened there. And that's where our legacies were built together as a family. And the other thing is living. And while David died in the living room, our goal throughout his process was that he would live until he died rather than seek cure and fight a battle to cancer in order for a cure or a miracle. He chose to live until the very end. And so the living room has kind of a joint meaning for us.
Now, what percent of people do some form of hospice? And when do you do it? So I've got two basic questions. And then the third thing is it mainly cancer patients who do it, or do people with other diseases, dementia and heart disease and the major debilitating diseases do it as well? So I've thrown three questions at you automatically, but they're interrelated.
Yeah, great questions. And it's changed over time. Hospice in this country is more than 50 years old. And finding statistics that encompass everyone in hospice is very difficult because there's no federal requirement that hospice agencies turn in anything except the number that are on Medicare. So most of the best statistics are only about the Medicare patients. And about 40% of all Medicare patients will spend at least 2 days in a hospice program now. And that's a big difference over many years ago when I started. That's about 1.7 million people. And it used to be that the primary diagnosis was cancer. And in like 2011, there was about 50% of all hospice patients were cancer patients. But that's changed now to where it's about 24%. And you get dementia, heart disease, all kinds of diseases in there. So that has dramatically changed. On average, people will spend about 92 days in hospice. Less if you have cancer, more if you have dementia. That has to do with our really crummy way of being able to prognosticate, because Medicare requires that you have a life expectancy of 6 months. And we're really bad at knowing how to make those guesses. The crystal ball is really rusty and doesn't work very well.
Deborah, that's a life expectancy of 6 months or less. Is that correct?
That's correct. Yes.
So with cancer, that's somewhat predictable. With dementia, much harder to determine. And I suppose with heart disease as well.
So we'll see lengths of stay average with dementia, let's say about 155 days, where with cancer, it's more like about 27 days. Even though it's predictable, people are later to get in, so they don't live as long. The really tricky thing is that the median length of stay is actually much more revealing about the reality. And the median length of stay, of course, tells us that half the people that stay that long and half the people that don't stay that long. And it is 17 days. That's very short. That's very, very short when half of your patients don't even make it 17 days and creates crisis care many times. 10% don't make it more than 2 days.
Now, let's go back. Sometimes that's desirable, meaning some people want to go in hospice and terminate quickly, whereas other people want to go in and enjoy, if you will, live as long as they can. Now, what happens when they exceed that six-month period? If they go over 180 days, does Medicare stop paying for them?
Jimmy Carter is the number one hospice star right now. He's been in hospice more than a year. And he continues to qualify, not because he's Jimmy Carter, but because the normal progression of his disease, given his age and the stage of his dementia, means that he's got a life expectancy of 6 months or less. And so as long as there is a physician that can justify that and qualify that, and the documentation indicates that he's declining, then he's been able to stay on. There are people that outlive the 6 months for sure. But as I said, with a median length of stay of only 17 days, it's not a problem very often.
So Jimmy is increasing the average without changing the median much.
That's exactly right.
That's just a mathematical calculation. Sorry if I got too much in the weeds on that. But now that we've talked about somewhat the eligibility being a life expectancy of 6 months or less, Medicare and hospitalized, they have to be hospitalized before they go in?
No, the majority are not. They are referred from the community. And the majority of hospice care is delivered in a private residence. It may or may not be the actual homestead of the patient, but in a private residence, and that includes nursing homes, if the level of care is just regular long-term care, hospitalization happens to some and they enter that way, but the majority of people come on referral out of a physician's office.
Now, who is this beneficial for? Tell us what happens in hospice and why this is a desirable way of having a pathway to the beyond.
I will use my personal experience to help supplement an explanation. So when you are not in hospice and you want to see your physician or you want to receive medical care, no one is coming into your house. You go to the clinic or you physically go to an emergency room if you have a problem at 2 a.m. If you have a problem at home at 2 a.m, you don't know if you should go to the emergency room. You don't have anybody to call. there's nobody standing by to help you make that decision. You don't usually pick up the phone and call your doctor, let's say, and you don't have a nurse that's coming in. I remember the very day that they came and enrolled my husband in hospice, even though I've been doing hospice for years, when you're on the other side as the caregiver, it's a whole different experience. The overwhelming relief that I had that now I had somebody else that I can call, and that no longer did we need to go in to have somebody physically examine him, because we had a nurse coming into our home, and getting him in to the clinic or certainly into an ER was an actually dangerous experience. He was very difficult to transfer, very difficult time to walk. And of course, that only gets worse. So having the ability to make that phone call when you have any question, any doubt, 24 hours a day, every single day of the year, if it's Christmas or not, was very reassuring, not only to the care that David received, but to me as a caregiver, because that's a huge burden to have to make those assessments. Is that serious enough to go in? Is it serious enough to go into the ER? What are they going to do when we get there? And then that whatever treatments are needed, if it's a change in medication, or let's say it's even hooking up an IV, adding oxygen, the nurse comes out and helps you do that, and helps you figure out and gets that all arranged for you. It's not a matter of you just go home and have to figure it out yourself.
We are talking with the expert in the world on hospice, certainly one of the most experienced. Legacies from the Living Room.com is how you can find out her website. The book is Legacies from the Living Room, A Love Grief Equation. Her name is Dr. Deborah Parker Oliver, Oliver. She's the Ira Codner, IRA, Codner, KODNER, Professor of Research at Wash U in St. Louis, one of our outstanding medical institutions. So I take it that sometimes these are at home and sometimes hospice is in an institution. What I learned early on, and I don't know if it's still true, so you correct me, but I was on a hospice board early on, and one of the things that was always problematic was we got a set amount of money per day, irrespective of the medications used. So there was always worry about using up the expensive medications in hospice and not having a financially viable setting. Obviously, hospices, thus the real program, has to be supported at least in part by philanthropy. Talk a little bit about, is that the same situation now? And one of the great things about hospice is the trained caregivers who help you, the caregiver, find some peace and ability, as you said, to call them at any time, but also they've got experiences in how to make the loved one or patient much more comfortable and to ease their transition. So I've spoken a little bit of your language now, and the real question is there a financial limit? And is it better done in the home or in a facility if you have the choice?
So you bring up a couple of really interesting questions. The first one is about 90% of hospice is actually delivered in the home. The hospice Medicare benefit was designed to be intermittent assistance from the hospice professional team. And so it's not, unless there's a crisis, it's not that somebody comes in all the time. And I think that's kind of a misnomer that people have. They don't quite understand that when they're at home and they're getting hospice care, that the nurse isn't there all the time, that the nurse is going to come in intermittently. Now, that may be every day if care depends on that, but the caregiver is the one that's responsible for the bulk of the care with support from the hospice team. That is paid at one, it's called the routine home care, and it is paid per day at a certain level, about $100, $150. It depends on where you live and all kinds of things. And for that money, hospice provides all the medications, supplies, equipment, and professional help related to the terminal diagnosis. So if your terminal diagnosis is cancer and you're getting pain medication, you're getting symptom drugs, all of that is covered, but your cholesterol medication wouldn't be covered, for instance. And every diagnosis, that determination has to be made as to what is covered and what is not. And if you choose to go get an experimental chemotherapy or radiation therapy, it's still covered in that $100 or $150 a day. The whole premise is that everything that makes you comfortable, not that tries to prolong your life, but that makes you comfortable, is covered under that amount of money for routine home care. Then if, let's say, there is a crisis that develops, your pain gets out of control, and you do need the skills of a skilled nurse more than 8 hours in any one calendar day, then it bumps up to what we call continuous home care. And so the hospice is paid actually per hour up to a cap for that service, depending on how many hours the nurse is in your home. So if you end up at midnight with pain that's completely out of control because something horrible has happened, and the nurse comes in and has to monitor that and be a part of that and get that all tweaked for you until the middle of the next day, every one of those hours is paid for and reimbursed. That's continuous home care. It makes up about 1% is all of hospice care. The same, there's a level of care called respite care, that if the caregiver becomes exhausted and unable to care for the patient, and getting them out into a facility for up to 5 days will help the caregiver and keep the patient controlled, that's another level of care with another reimbursement. The criteria for that is that that place that that happens has to be staffed by at least an RN. So sometimes if nursing homes have beds that are staffed by an RN, respite care happens there. Again, that's maybe 1% of the hospice care days that are given. If you can't be controlled at home under any of those circumstances and you have a crisis and you need inpatient care, care that can only be delivered in an environment of skilled nature, with nurses and doctors and everyone around the clock, be that a hospice facility, which we have only a few in this country, or a hospice unit within a hospital, we have more of those, or even a hospice unit within a nursing home, then indeed that's covered at a larger amount per day, like $500 per day. And again, it covers all the professional care, all the medications connected to the terminal illness, all the tests and procedures connected to the terminal illness, and any supplies that are needed. Inside an inpatient unit, that money gets eaten up really quick. Unfortunately, what we've had is some abuse within the hospice system, and our regulators have come in and really crushed, I don't know what other term to use, a lot of providers of hospice inpatient care. And so the criteria is very tight. A lot of time is and energy is spent on documenting that this is indeed care that can only happen in this facility. So in order to be profitable under those circumstances, hospices have to be really creative around the drugs and the treatments that they give. And so they try the least invasive and the least expensive and work their way up in order to be able to manage within that cost structure. It's indeed a skill. Sometimes what we've seen is that we've had, it used to be mostly charity, and what you say is true, philanthropy that made hospices survive. And the majority, overwhelming majority, were not-for-profit. I've only worked for not-for-profit myself in a day. What we've seen in recent years is tremendous growth in the for-profit sector of hospice. And research has shown that care is different from a for-profit, just as it is in the nursing home industry, that for-profit agencies deliver services differently and quality of care can sometimes be compromised. So consequently, there's not a lot of profit margin there. And so if you're going to make profit, how do you make profit? When you're paid per day, you make profit by getting people in earlier and getting diagnoses that require less treatment, like Alzheimer's disease, like going into nursing homes, because oftentimes you're not paying as the same amount of labor for somebody who's got a more skilled 24-hour caregiver and is in an institutional setting. And so abuse can happen. We've had a lot of trouble about that, and it's caused a big controversy within the industry. When 75%, and there's a lot of buying this agency and buying that agency and changing of policies and procedures that make it very complicated. But the premise is that indeed, the patient sees no bill. There's no bill that comes out of that. Everything that you need related to the terminal illness is covered regardless of the level of care that you're in. It's a matter of making sure that you get all the care that you need and all the professional services that you need. And that's why the service is pretty regulated and all of those claims are reviewed and they're regularly surveyed to make sure that those abuses don't happen.
And the caregiver gets no bill either.
That's right.
And we should say one of the real important aspects of this is the respite or the break the caregiver gets rather than going to a respite unit. But the confidence and knowledge that they're doing the best they can for their loved one as they pass on.
One of the ways that respite care is delivered in the home by hospice is through the use of volunteers. They are required by regulation to offer 10% of their patient care hours by volunteers. And so they have carefully trained volunteers who can go in and sit with people, with patients, so that the caregiver can get rest, even if it's to go in the other room and go to sleep, or to go to the grocery store to get a little bit of a break, or to go in and actually visit with a patient if it's early enough and talk softball or talk football or whatever the patient needs for some companionship, because it's a very isolating condition. And the hospice volunteers are actually pretty underutilized in most agencies. And so that's always something that people should grab onto and utilize and take advantage of, because it's a fundamental part of the entire hospice philosophy.
Deborah, I want to thank you. This is Dr. Deborah Parker Oliver. You can go to find her book and more information on hospice at legaciesfromtheLivingRoom.com or Amazon. Dr. Deborah Parker Oliver, look up, I did, Deborah, D-E-B-R-A, Parker, P-A-R-K-E-R, Oliver, and you'll find her book, excellent book. One of the volunteers, Deborah, used to be the co-host of this program early on, and it's 100 and 200, and he said one of the most important things was remember, never say, I know what you're feeling, because you never do.
That's right.
As a volunteer, he said. But in any case, I should tell our audience, thank you very much. We are brought to you by Life's First Naturals, the makers of Truebiotics, Bovine Colostrum, and Dye, D-I-A, Res, R-E-S-Q, the letter Q, Dye Rescue. Look at that if you're on one of the GLPs like Ozempic, Wegovy, Mounjaro, or Tirzepatide. It helps the transition to increase doses and smooth that transition, as well as go to longevityplaybook.com and sign up for their free newsletter. Deborah, I can't thank you enough, and thank you for all your devotion to this. I hope it's gotten into the medical school curriculum in a serious way. I got to also thank, of course, you, our listening audience. This is the reason we do it. This is 1214B. Which means we've been doing this for more than 20 years. Thank you for continuing to listen to us. The 50,000 of you who download us weekly can't all be wrong. Thanks again. And remember, if you want a great book on this, Legacies from the Living Room by Deborah Parker Oliver. Thanks again.